Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, an eclectic thunderclap of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we meet the mass folk world fusion phenomena that is the Birmingham Royal Conservatoire's folk ensemble as they flex their stage-busting muscle on the start of a national tour. We dig into the archive of Birmingham's musical heritage by way of a new community project, reawakening the glory of the city's dance and trance at the Q Club. And we consider the life and contribution of composer, Morris dancer, and music collector George Butterworth by way of a compelling new documentary film. For more information, links, and an archive of previous shows, check out our website www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with the mighty Conservatoire Folk Ensemble, a joyous mix of en masse, world-tinged live music, and proudly the UK's biggest folk band. In the early stages of their current tour, I caught up with ensemble members Helena Britton and Emily Carter to get behind the motivations, modes, and marvel of this Birmingham-based treasure. So I'm here with Helena and Emily from the Conservatoire Folk Ensemble. Now there's lots of French words there. And there's a royal as well now, isn't there, in the Conservatoire?
Yes.
So
yes.
I should probably work that in at some point.
Might be a bit too long then.
Yeah, it's probably not get on the business card, will it, that? So, thanks for coming in.
No problem.
First of all, and let's start with Folk Ensemble, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I came to one of your concerts a couple of weeks ago, I thought, well, what does that mean? What does folk music mean? But it's a whole mixture of things, isn't it? It's not. I think people often have a perception of folk that it's
a man with a beard
yep. and a guitar,
yeah.
but it's not that, is it?
No, well, definitely not our type of folk. And actually, not all folk really is that man with a beard.
No,
there's only
it's definitely
even
not.
Joe doesn't have a beard. So yeah, well, yeah, it's just a mixture of all types of world music, I suppose.
Yeah.
With a folk influence underneath.
Yeah, it's kind of all of the tunes are classic folk tunes almost.
Yeah.
But it's just rather than the man with a guitar and a beard, it's 50 to 80 people that, like, in our specific ensemble.
Clean shaven.
At the time.
So that's yeah. quite impressive because I think I'm right in saying it's the UK's biggest folk band.
Definitely.
Okay, so you've got over 50 members.
Over 50.
Altogether, there's about 80.
Yeah.
But obviously,
this year's been the largest year so far.
Yeah.
Emily was one of the new recruits this year.
Yes, I was. Because my instrument isn't exactly a classic folk instrument because I play the French horn. But it's quite good, actually, because any instrument you can think of is in the ensemble. We've got all
yeah.
sorts of stuff.
That's also why it's not
nice.
So much traditional folk music, because it's French horn. What else have we got in there
got
that's not
sitar.
Traditional? Yeah, sitar. A crazy electronic clarinet, I think it is,
yeah,
which is
it's
great.
Called an iwi, I think.
An iwi,
yeah.
there you go.
Yeah,
wow.
An iwi.
Careful how you ask for that.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's traditional folk with so many different things fused into it, and there's always a banging bass line.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite a difficult thing to describe in one short sentence because there's so many different elements to it, but the most yeah. important thing is that it's just loads of fun.
When I was at your concert, somebody asked me what I thought, okay? It's always a dangerous thing to ask me, and I said, if you were travelling through space, okay, and you saw Earth, that's what you'd want to see on Earth. You know, a very positive
yeah,
kind of
that's
sound
great.
Mix
yeah.
of things.
Because it takes in loads of different cultures, especially our folk ensemble, because we're
yeah.
based at Conservatoire and you've got quite a few like foreign students and they always bring different elements to it as well. So
yeah.
we've got quite a few 7/8 of like Bulgarian tunes and we had this amazing Bulgarian player a couple of years back and she brought loads of stuff to the band and, you know, that always happens, just different people bring different parts of their culture, and like we have an Australian guy in it this year called Tom who's written his own tune, but although I think he hasn't based it's not like Australian folk, what is it, I don't know.
No, it's
I don't know, was it Sardinia, I can't quite remember, but
like
he's
that.
Written his own tune and
yeah.
that's incredible. So again, it's just like an Australian person drawing on different countries' folk traditions and mashing it all together and making 80 people play it. So
yeah.
Now according to my homework, you've got an 18 piece horn section, 5 cellists, 7 percussionists, 5 electric guitars, fiddles, flutes, clarinets, a euphonium, an
yeah.
accordion, and your own voices as well.
Yes.
Yeah. That's quite a mix, as well as the things that you've already mentioned.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you'd know more than us. We just turn up and go, oh, this sounds nice.
Yeah.
So your instrument is the violin, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Violin, so.
So how does that fit in that kind of ensemble? Is it? I'm interested in how individual instruments kind of add to this.
I think the violin tends to do the tuney bits, unless we, as a band, we get our heads together and come up with different riffs and different parts to go with tunes. So violins usually play the tune section, although there are parts when we do like the riff as well, but yeah, many tunes.
So you all come to the ensemble because you're studying music, you're kind of committed musicians, is that right?
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about your journey to kind of, you know, so you're saying you just entered the kind of ensemble, so.
Yeah, I didn't actually know what the folk ensemble was until I got here. I hadn't heard of it because of where I lived. But one of my friends who did it last year said, I'll put your name down for it, you can try it. And if you like it, she's another horn player. She was the only horn player in it last year, and she's roped another four of us to go along with her this year. And I went for the week and thought, wow, this is fantastic. I absolutely loved it. Because when we learn it, it's all by ear. So we don't have any music written down. So as well as kind of helping develop in that kind of sense, you meet an awful lot more people. Like, I didn't know Helena.
Nope.
Before folk ensemble, and like you get so many more new friends, and it's just kind of the atmosphere of it is just fantastic, and it's just fun, which is kind of like there's no point in doing it if you're not enjoying yourself. So
now your band leader Joe Broughton,
yeah,
he said, I think at the concert I went to, he said that you come together every week,
for
a couple of hours as a kind of jam.
Yeah,
is that as chaotic as it sounds?
No, it's not. It's actually really, really surprisingly organised. Mm. It's every Tuesday for 2 hours. We all come together, and like Emily said, everything's done by ear. So Joe will play something, and then we play it back to him, and we just do that on repeat. And it will take us maybe like a 2 hour session to learn a whole tune, and then we'll just finally tune it. And members will sort of pipe up if they think that something might be different or they should do something else, and then that's just basically how we get the tunes together, really. So Joe is obviously the grand master. He shows us how to do things, and then we just come together as a band and work it out that way, really. And Joe is, one, a really impressive musician, and two, just really good at like getting everyone together and making everyone feel really enthusiastic. So it's surprisingly unchaotic. You might think that it's a room of like 80 manic people just playing over the top of each other, but it's not. It works really, really well. And then we all go to the pub afterwards and like get chatting and find out different things about each other.
Ensembles and groups such as yours, that it's very controlled and very strict. You know, there are a lot of kind of, you know, very strict sort of things imposed upon it, and that's true to an extent. But you kind of go wild when you come on the stage. Literally, you go wild.
Yeah, there is no, there's nothing that we're not allowed to do apart from maybe crowd diving, crowd surfing.
Not yet.
Not yet. Please, Joe. No. I think There's nothing we're not allowed to do. It's like we come up with dance moves, we do funny little sliding across the stage. It's just whatever you feel like doing at the time, just go for it. And that's the best thing, really, about, well, there's many, many things that are the best thing, but yeah, there's nothing we're not allowed to do, which keeps it fresh and it keeps it people entertained, I think. If we did the same thing year in, year out, then maybe it wouldn't be quite as exciting, but, and it keeps on getting bigger as well. You've got 80 people doing dance moves and even little stupid things, like when we take a bow, we like do a virtual backbend and just stuff like that. That just makes it all really fun. So
Emily, you mentioned at the start about looking at kind of new ways of playing old songs, if that's one way of putting it. And you've made a number of records, which is great. I think the first sort of studio album you made was called Painted.
Yeah.
But you've got a new or recent, let's say, mini album, which is called Sleepy Maggie. Okay. Now tell me a bit about that, because I think it's sort of a song that's explored in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Sleepy Maggie, I think, is a traditional folk tune that has then been completely altered by various different members of the band. So Fraser, what does Fraser play?
He plays baritone saxophone.
That's our Barry Sax.
That's one of the big saxophones, isn't it?
Yeah, massive. And he dances around, like he's not sitting down. But anyway, he wrote like a acid house tune or something, like a really crazy version, and somebody's turned it into a bit like a James Bond ballad, and then there's another one that's sort of been massively altered. So it's just an album full of these different versions of Sleepy Maggie, and they all sound amazing, and they're all written by people that are in the band, so you should buy it.
You should go and buy that as well, okay. And it's a good demonstration of, I think, again, sort of trying to not get away from, but try and test, I suppose, people's kind of understanding of folk or world music. I mean, those labels in some ways aren't helpful, but there's a point, I think, in the show, certainly that I came to, where the fairy dance, which I think everybody knows what the fairy dance is, or a lot of people should know what it is, but there's a point where you start playing the fairy dance, almost kind of, I suppose, parodying it in terms of it being a little bit pedestrian, a little bit kind of tired, and then again, you hit the wild button, and start doing all kinds of interesting things with it. And it, I guess the audience response to that is different every time you take it out.
Yeah, I think, because we play at various different places, but sort of play at quite a few folk clubs, so I guess our parody at the beginning when we're like, oh, dun, 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 when we do that bit, I suppose they probably think, oh, it's great. But actually, I guess what we're trying to show is folk music exists in pretty much all music, has originated from folk music, and it's taking the basic song and then just showing how it can be worked and like moved into something different. I mean, I quite like that song, even the inverted commas, the boring bit, I think it's great, but I guess it's just showing that folk is the basis of all music and you can do whatever you want with it.
about touring, because as we said at the start, you are a massive group, but not all of you, I don't think, go out onto all of the kind of tour venues.
No, well, not all of them would fit everybody in.
So you haven't got a big enough bus, I guess. No. Is that the issue?
No, well, we can normally take about a coach load, so about 50
people.
Yeah,
50-something.
But basically, we give our availability to Joe, and he'll... make sure that everyone gets their fair share of gigs.
He'll cull us. No, he won't.
So there's something called the Power Folk 6 lineup. Is that right?
Yes.
So that's, I guess, a kind of, not a select group, but a kind of a core group of people, and the kind of the group play around, or how does that
work? It changes from like Emily said, so you put down your availability. It just slightly changes on each lineup, just so everyone gets the opportunity to go and play. And then we just go to various different places. Sometimes I think we're doing Towsy Festival this year, which is going to be really cool. And then we just travel around the country for a couple of weeks and eat loads of food, drink beer, play amazing music, make new friends.
It sounds like a rock and roll lifestyle, but through folk, maybe.
Yeah, well, who's to say that folk isn't rock and roll?
Well, indeed. So in terms of some of the dates you've got coming up, on Friday the 7th of June, you're playing at Huntingdon Hall in Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
On the 9th of June, you're at the Spotted Dog in Birmingham.
Yes. Yeah, that's a wild one.
That sounds like a wild night. You mentioned the Towsy Festival, which is coming up on the 26th of August. And I think if folks want to find out more details and tickets and things like that, the best place for them to go is www.folkensemble.co.uk.
That's the one.
I think that's the one. But you've got Facebook and Twitter.
We've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got Instagram. We've got all of the tweeting things.
Social media.
All the online social medias. Actually, that's an interesting thing. If you want to follow us through our tour, then each gig we do, a new person takes over our Instagram account. So you will see folk in various different lights. So it might be Emily and her tap dancing
yeah.
Or it could be one of the cellists or anything. So yeah, follow us on Instagram. I think it's just Joe Borton Folk Ensemble. And check us out.
So just finally, I just want to ask you, you obviously have a lot of fun through the ensemble, and it also, I think, gives you different, like we said, different skills, or, you know, kind of, I guess, professional kind of elements in terms of your careers and your kind of learning. And I'm just conscious of, I just wanted to ask you kind of, what is your game plan? Where do you see yourselves in, you know, sort of 5-10 years time? I mean, studying music, as a full-time thing, is a big commitment, is it? Where perhaps do you see your sort of your playing and your style developing?
Well, I mean, I left college 4 years ago and managed to cling on to folk ensemble because it's the best thing, but I think for me it's just doing as much music as possible. So in 5 years time I'm most likely going to be doing pretty much the same thing, which is just teaching and gigging and organising gigs.
And Emily, but how about you as a relatively newcomer to this?
Yeah, well, as I'm first year, I don't finish my degree for another 3 years yet, so I suppose if I'm in Birmingham, if they'll still have me, I'd quite like to stay. But yeah,
I'm still here, it'll be fine.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing really. I just want to keep playing my music. That's kind of the career goal anyway, so I don't know whether I'll be doing a master's or not yet, but either way it'll be music.
I think that's a very strong message to give to our listeners. So best of luck with the rest of the tour.
Thank you very much.
And enjoy those gigs we've mentioned. And,
thank you.
Thanks for coming in to talk to me.
No problem. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box on Switch Radio with me, James Sandy. And now, music history and heritage by way of a new project seeking volunteers to help capture the goings-on and happenings at Birmingham's Q Club, which closed its doors at the Methodist Central Hall on Corporation Street in 2017. Taking to the keen streets of Brum, I caught up with project coordinator Jez Collins to get the lowdown. Okay, so Jez, we're here to talk about quite an exciting project around the Q Club. So let's start firstly about, if folks are listening and don't know what the Q Club is or where it is, okay. Let's start with that.
Okay, so the Q Club was located in the Central Methodist Hall on Corporation Street in Birmingham, right opposite the Magistrates' Courts, just around the corner from the Children's Hospital. There's three big imposing Victorian buildings, red brick buildings or terracotta buildings that form that sort of that triangle. And the Central Methodist Hall was opened 140 years ago, I think it was. Maybe my dates might be a bit out of there. And obviously for the majority of its time was the, you know, a place for the Methodists to meet and hold their rallies and whatnot. But in 1989, it became known as the Q Club. And the Q Club was a live music and then became sort of a dance and rave culture space. So live music and recorded music, but it was a place where people would come to listen to music.
And it had quite a reputation, I think, in terms of later perhaps a kind of dance and rave culture, but before that it was quite a place to play.
Yeah, oh gosh, well it's an incredible building, so it's hard to sort of picture it, but it's some 200 rooms, I think it has, throughout its throughout the building. But the main hall, or the Great Hall, is this really imposing space. It's a big oval. At one end you had this huge stage with a really important organ that was made. I think it was the sister of the one that's in the town hall. So you had this, you imagine the preachers and the recitals going on, standing up there to a packed hall. Playing on that stage with that backdrop was incredible. And if you're on the stage and looking out, and it held about 2,000 people, so it was a sizable space. But up above were rows of racked seating, sort of leather seating. And funnily enough, they were some of the most things that people talk about the most, the seating in there, because you could look down into this pit or onto the stage. And with the light shows going on and stuff. So it was an amazing place. When you walk through the door, you queue up the street to get in, and you'd walk through these beautiful doors into a tiled area, and you'd have these concrete, you can again imagine these Victorian, big solid concrete stairs that went left and right, and you went up to them, and then you went through the door. It was fantastic, a great space.
So there's quite a lot that went on in that space, and now let's talk about a project that you've kind of kick-started, which is really to sort of, I suppose, capture things that went on.
Yeah, so I am a sort of a lapsed academic, so I left BCU, Birmingham City University, last year to concentrate on projects full-time for an organisation that I run called the Birmingham Music Archive. And the Birmingham Music Archive seeks to capture, document, preserve, share, celebrate Birmingham's music, history, heritage and culture. And we do that in a number of ways. So we have ostensibly it's an online, so it's a digital archive where people upload their memories and their materials, photographs, files, etc. And their written memories. And then we have an associated Facebook page where people just throw so much stuff out, I can't keep up.
It's a real treasure trove,
and it's really important. And I started really because, if you go to the museum and art gallery, for example, the Central Library, there's nothing really about music history in this city, and it has a really rich, long, vibrant, and unique history, I'd say, in terms of the acts, particularly the bands that have come from here. But it's not captured or archived, and so no one, you can't go and find out about those things. So if you're a young person and you're looking for inspiration about music, how do you find out, how do you find out some of the heroes who have come from the city? Well, you go to places that have those materials, and you look and they inspire you. And we don't do it in this city, so I started the archive to do that. So it has that, the digital archive, it has the Facebook group page. We have a community of about 7,000 people who interact and upload, interrogate, retrieve those materials and add those materials, and then I take that and I create projects from them, and I'll talk about the Q Club a bit more in a second, but I do tours, I've made films, radio shows, installations and exhibitions, written material. So we take all this material and then chuck it back out into the world, so
you
people
never
really
can do short content for that
no well no I could always do more, there's never enough. I think we've probably got a small proportion of the things that are out there, because what happens is that there are two things to look at. You have the sort of well-known bands, so you think about Black Sabbath or Duran Duran, for example. They'll have their own archives, their materials that reside with the band, and they'll exploit them for commercial activities, so they no longer reside in the city, which is a great shame. You might be able to go to a museum, a music museum, and see some of them as part of that, but Black Sabbath, everything about Black Sabbath, one of the world's great bands, really important bands, and all their material resides elsewhere at the city and not in the city where it's formed. And then you have the other archives, which are personal archives, and people keep these materials. So the easiest way to think about, if you're listening in, is to think about all the photographs that you have now, probably more digital than physical, but they're all stuffed in cupboards, and we very rarely look at them, but they're there. And sometimes we might get them out and we reminisce, and it prompts memories. Or if you think about how you might put some of your photographs or arrange some of your photographs or your pictures around your house or your sentimental ornaments, you know, we care about them. They you know, connect us for us. And people keep the things of popular music, so they do keep ticket stubs, they do keep photographs, they do keep posters and flyers and all this other material that oftentimes is getting chucked out and is not kept. And when you then ask people to share those things, it creates memories or prompts memories, and you get these narratives. So you learn so much more about, you know, the role that music plays for individuals and communities and the role that it plays in the social, cultural and political life of a city. And that's what I try and do through the archive. And the Q Club is that personified. It's a space that's really important for the city, for people who went there, people like me and others who went there. But it's also a place where David Bowie played a secret gig in 97. It's bands like Blur and Suede and Pulp and James and the Chemical Brothers played there. It's where Daft Punk, who are a really important electronic band electronic dance band from France, they loved their gig at the Q Club so much. It's where they released their live album. The BBC used it as a way for... or as part of their essential mix, so you'd have DJs like Carl Cox and Paul Oakenfold and Pete Tong would be broadcasting live from doing live music sets from the Q Club, which were then released on CD. You had really amazing rave and dance nights like House of God, which is one of the great techno club nights across the city. Space Opera, Sunday Central, Flashback, really, some of them global, some of them national importance, but most of all important for the people who were there at that time, at that place, in this city.
The project that you're running, the kind of heritage project that the Music Archive is running, you're doing that with Viewfinder, and you've got Heritage Lottery Fund funding, which is quite exciting.
It's the first time I've had Heritage Lottery funding, and so I'm really, really sort of thankful for that. And that allows us to, well, that's paying for us to go and do the interviews, to do the scanning, to do the exhibitions, and to sort of run this project. And we are, as part of that, we're looking for volunteers to get involved, to help us sort of capture that stuff, to help us do the recordings, to help us scan, to help us do the exhibitions, to perhaps do some of the admin, some of the more boring stuff. But it's a way for people to learn more about their own city. You don't have to live in the city to do it, but I imagine if you're going to volunteer, you will be. But it's a way of finding out more about the city and the things that have gone on there. You might have a love of music, so it's a way of working with music and help us track down some of these recordings and photographs. It might be that you just enjoy volunteering and you've got some time on your hands and you want to learn some new skills, whether that's filmmaking or audio recording or how you might scan for digital preservation purposes. So there's loads of opportunities for people to get involved. And Viewfinder, Matt from Viewfinder, is a filmmaker, so we're going to be making a short film, like a 18-minute film, of the people that we're interviewing and of the Q Club. And I think I'm really excited about that, because I think we will unearth materials that we don't know about yet, and I think we could have a fantastic film that could go out to film festivals, because again, without it's hard to imagine, but it was such visually an incredible space. And some of these nights, like House of God, would dress the venue up in outrage. There'd be fire eaters and people on stilts in these dark, just walking around in these dark clubs. They'd make that space and they'd dress it so it was almost theatrical. And you go in, you'd be hearing this huge, really loud techno boom music going on, but all around you'd be all these colours and these visuals. So I'm really excited that the film element might actually, progress the project even further than we're hoping. But ostensibly, what we're doing the project for is to capture and document, it's never been done, that period of 20 odd years of people's musical history, heritage and culture in a really important space before it's too late and people are no longer with us or those materials are lost forever.
So it's open, I guess, to folks who've got a musical interest in some way and an interest in Birmingham. But who do you want? What sort of, are you sort of a broad range of skills, but what do you want from people?
Well, I think it's a commitment to, if they want to get involved, is a commitment just for 3 hours a week. We can't pay people, but we can pay travel expenses and buy them sandwiches and whatnot, and hopefully give them new skills. But I'm just interested in anyone who is interested in Birmingham and find out more about it and helping us celebrate it more. It might be, you know, social media people who want to help market it or promote it. It might be press people who are really good at writing press releases or talking to people. It might be people who actually are really good at talking to companies and saying, look, we've got this project on, do you want to sponsor us and give us some, I don't know, some Sennheiser headphones as part of a company? Because, you know, there's a broad range of skills that we need. It's a big project. You know, we have a lot of the skills ourselves, and we could probably do it ourselves, to be honest, but that's time consuming, and the idea being that, you know, if you do love music or music culture, or you do love the city or the built environment, you know, we might have people who are just really keen on the architectural merits of the building and thinking about how, you know, that's represented. Or we might have people who are really good with tech and might say, actually, you know what, we could build an app to do some VR stuff on that. There's a myriad of ways. We just need the commitment, and we need people to, you know, I'm really open for people to say, actually, this is what I enjoy doing. Can I get involved? Rather than me saying, these are what we need doing, will you do it? I'd much rather people told us what they wanted to do, and we said, okay, yeah, that's a great idea. You know, why don't we see if we can make that work?
So tell me, when I was reading through all the kind of wonderful things that the project is, tell me about this idea of ghost gigs. Tell me that, because that sounds scary, but it's not.
It might be. So, before I talk you about the ghost gigs, the reason why we put it in, we were working with the developers, Seal Capital, who have bought the building. So the building has gone through planning and was due to be converted one half into staycation. So the other half was going to be a new hotel chain called Dreamers, I think, who were based in America, global hotel chain. But the first in Europe was going to be the other half of the building. And then in the Grand Hall that I've talked about earlier, they were going to do a sort of gastronomic element where the mezzanine was open cooking and members of the public could go in so you could see the building but also eat. So the really great plans, and we were chatting to them and talking about the significance of the building, and they offered us a space within the building which is currently sort of locked and boarded up, you can't get into it, but they were going to give us one of the retail spaces underneath it, and we were going to base the project in there. And what we wanted to do there, which we'll now have to find somewhere else to do, is this thing called ghost gigs that you mentioned. And ghost gigs are basically replaying a gig or music in the venue that it happened. So, for example, we've got the footage of David Bowie when he did his secret gig in 97. We've got footage of that, and so what we're going to do is project it in the club and ask people to come. They'll just come down and listen to it and watch it, but also, you know, did you go there? Have you got photographs yourself? What are your memories? And capture some of that. So, or we might do replay one of the Essential Mixes or the Daft Punk album. So we're going to do a series of these ghost gigs. Not quite sure where they're going to take place, though. That's any trouble. So, and the idea being that you do them in the place where they're at. It doesn't look like we'll be able to do that, so we'll just still call them a ghost gig, but we'll find another venue for it.
Like most hauntings, it has to be elusive.
It has to be. It's very elusive, yeah, and you know, and not believable.
Okay, so Jez, folks that are listening that are fired up by what you've said about the project around the Q Club and about the music archive, how do they get in touch? How do they get involved?
Very simple. They can email me, jez@intheq.co.uk or jez@birminghammusicarchive.com. You can go on the Facebook page, which is Birmingham Music Archive Group. You can find me on Twitter @BrumMusicPix. So I'm around a lot on social media sites, but the email, jez@intheq.co.uk or jez@BirminghamMusicArchive.com. Just drop me an email and I'll come have a coffee and just have a chat and see, you know, how you want to get involved, or just if you want to find out more about the project, it'd be great. We really want people to get involved with it.
Excellent. Well, we shall keep tabs on your
progress.
And
perhaps come down to one of the ghost gigs.
We shall meet again, as they say. But for now,
don't know where, don't know when.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks, James. Thanks for talking to me. Cheers.
Cheers. Now, just a quick mention of Birmingham's 5th Indian Film Festival, which will be opening on Friday, the 21st of June, and running until Monday, the 1st of July. An 11-day festival of independent films, it runs across a variety of city venues. For more details on the full range of events, go to www.birminghamindianfilmfestival.co.uk. And finally, All My Life's Buried Here is a dedicated documentary film exploring the life, work, and untimely departure of composer George Butterworth. To get a better understanding of Butterworth's place in British music and dance, I spoke to film director and producer Stuart Morgan Hudukiewicz.
Okay, so I'm with Stuart, who's the director of a new film called All My Life's Buried Here, The Story of George Butterworth. And Stuart, thanks for taking time to talk to us. I want to start with George Butterworth, because a lot of people might know the name, but they might not perhaps understand who he is. So let's start with that.
Well, George Butterworth was a remarkable figure, and this is what prompted me to try and make this film about him and tell his story of his life. He was a composer, and he's best known as a composer now, but he was also a folk song collector and traditional dancer as well. He packed so much into his 31 years, and of course, the last 2 years of his life, he was a soldier too, because he volunteered to join the army when World War I was declared. But he's probably best known, as I say, for his orchestral compositions, such as The Banks of Green Willow and the Rhapsody, A Shropshire Lad, and for his settings of the poetry of A.E. Houseman's Shropshire Lad collection. And that material does get played on the radio and is fairly widely known. Perhaps what's less known is his activities as a collector and a dancer. So we try and bring all of that to the fore in the film.
So he's kind of presented as, or is described as, a part of a kind of radical movement in sort of British music, and sort of with the, in terms of time period, as you've alluded to, we're talking about the beginning of the kind of 20th century, just prior to the First World War. And this radical tradition was, I suppose, a marked change from what came before it. But let's explore that word radical. What did he do that was different?
Well, Butterworth was part of a generation. He was born in 1885, so he really reached maturity in those Edwardian years. And he was part of a generation, I think, across a lot of the art forms, not just music, that did seek to rebel against their Victorian forebears, especially their fathers. I think you can look at someone like D.H. Lawrence as well, who wrote about some of this in his novels. And Butterworth was a rebel, actually, in his own time. And that was manifested in his exploration and use of folk song, for example, in his orchestral compositions, which would have been unheard of 20 to 30 years before. As somebody says in the film, in an interview, up until about 1860, any what later became known as folk music would have been dismissed as the kind of, you know, the noises of the peasants or something like that. It was a very hierarchical structure to society in those days. I think it's important to remember that too. It was a very different time. And by heading out into the countryside and not only collecting, but actually befriending the singers in order to collect, because remember, you cannot steal someone's song. They have to sing it to you, they have to give it to you. So if you're a collector like George Butterworth, you have to go out and have a rapport and form an understanding and a trust relationship with these singers. That demonstrates the love and appreciation that was genuinely held by Butterworth and his ilk at that time for the music of the rural singers. And that is a very important moment, I think, in English cultural history, because it was one of the earliest times when it was acknowledged that normal people had culture, if you can say that. You know, wouldn't have been until 1950 that you get academics like Raymond Williams writing, "Culture is normal, this is where we must begin." And that was groundbreaking in the 50s, but we're talking half a century before that. So in his time, he was very radical, in my opinion. And I think that has been, the impression of that has been lost through the years, for various reasons.
So the folk music element is significant here, I think, and the film paints a portrait, I think a beautiful portrait, of Ralph Vaughan Williams, another musical titan, and George Butterworth striding out mainly across sort of Sussex and bits of Suffolk, I think, as well, and kind of the east coast of England, trying to capture songs. And as you said, some of it was sort of befriending, knocking on doors, finding sort of a network that was kind of hidden in some ways. How did he physically capture them? I mean, obviously he got people to recite them, but technology being what it was then, I guess it was quite difficult to record. I know phonographs were kind of around in that time, but most of it was captured there and then in written form, I guess.
Yeah, Butterworth and his companion Vaughan Williams, and he had other people who went with him collecting as well. They usually went in pairs. And that was probably because they were generally writing down or transcribing the song as they listened to it. So one of them would capture the tune and the other would get the words in many cases. Sometimes the words were neglected or not recorded or not placed as important as the melody, because it was primarily melodies, you know, tunes that these composers were looking for. They, in their estimation, the beauty of a tune was what made it valuable, and also the type of tune was what made it English, because they had a very quite a fixed set of standards by what they would classify as an English folk song. But yeah, they would have a manuscript book with them in many cases, and they would notate the song as it was sung, not always in the same key as it was sung, because they had to be able to write it quickly, and they would try and, you know, to as far as possible record it as accurately as they could from the way it was sung. On the occasions that the phonograph was used by George Butterworth and Vaughan Williams, we know they did carry one out with them on an East Anglian trip in 1910 and 11. It wasn't deemed very successful for various reasons. Vaughan Williams himself said he was hopeless with technology, and he was all sort of fingers and thumbs, so he had trouble working these Edison phonographs. But there's also a practical aspect of a sort of loss of the natural singing situation, because the singer had to put their face into a cone and sing right into a trumpet, a kind of copper trumpet, for that then to be registered on the wax cylinder, which is a very unnatural, you know, it could throw a singer off their words or
not
their tune.
Not quite as advanced as today's world.
Not quite as advanced as the microphone that we're recording on, yeah. But it was a matter of, you know, trying to get the essence of the tunes recorded. And, you know, there are different opinions on how accurate a lot of the collectors were, but you know, I think that's a debate that can be had. There were some collectors who insisted on, like Percy Grainger, you know, using the phonograph because it captured every you know, nuance of a singer's performance. But really, Butterworth and Vaughan Williams, they were looking for tunes. They weren't as interested in the fine nuances of every different version. And, you know, Butterworth collected over 300 different folk songs on his travels, and he went all over. He did mainly, as you said, go to the southeast of England and East Anglia, but he also went to Newport in what was then Monmouthshire, now Gwent. He went to Broseley in Shropshire. He went to the West Midlands. He collected in Oxfordshire as well, song and dance. And in Yorkshire as well on one or two occasions. So he did sort of stray a little bit further from that kind of southeast, but it was predominantly that area.
Now let's talk about you and the film, in terms of making the film and how you came to it. Is this something that you perhaps stumbled upon, this story, or is it something that sort of, you know, kind of a slow burn, you know, has become a sort of a fascination, I nearly said obsession, but a fascination over time?
Yeah, I mean, it does emerge gradually. I mean, any big project, yeah, like a feature film kind of does. I mean, I was, in 2015, I was looking for a subject for a longer form film, maybe an hour to an hour and a half. So I'd made shorter documentaries until that date. And I'm very interested in portrait films, and I'm very interested in social history, and in particularly social history of England, just because that's where I am. And I'd grown up with inherited beliefs about English identity and what and the symbolism and everything attached to it, and English music. And I was interested in that whole area. So I began to read and research, and I probably, you know, this the idea of a George Butterworth film was one of several possible routes to go down. But as I began reading and more, especially Anthony Murphy's biography, which is called Banks of Green Willow, I think that I read that soon after it was published in 2012. I very quickly then began to see all the ingredients, in my mind anyway, coming together of a feature documentary. And when you're talking about a cinema film, which is what I had in mind, that really was suggested to me by the material. You know, we've got George Butterworth's music, and we have everything he achieved in his lifetime, and we have this narrative curve which, you know, has an incredibly dramatic path, and ultimately a tragic one. So there's emotion there all the way through. So to me, it was like this material was like gold, you know, to work with. It was a real privilege to have this material and to work towards, you know, getting, gathering all the materials to put together into the film.
So I imagine a couple of challenges that you must have faced. One is trying to sort of pull together that archive to piece together that consistent picture. But the other is, I guess, funding, financing. You know, it's not easy to make a film, and certainly to make a film of this quality. So how did you sort of... I know there's a crowdfunding element, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, with funding, we bypassed the need for a proper budget by making the film quite slowly. If you're a BBC, if you're doing a one-hour film for the BBC, you probably get a budget of about £100,000 and you deliver the film in 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. This film we were working on from the initial idea for nearly four years, and something that was being done alongside part-time jobs. But it was a matter of, really being committed to tell the story because we thought it was worth telling. And if we hadn't, or if George hadn't been such a admirable character, actually, I've come out of the project and out of the editing stage quite liking the guy, this figure who, as far as you can know him, you know him. And I think if that hadn't been the case, I probably wouldn't have stayed the course, if he'd been some sort of, monstrous sort of character. So there was that too. It was about trying to put this story on screen and tell something that had been, I think, had been missing from the narrative of social history of classical music in England and in Britain, and to try and represent that life on screen. There was bits and pieces of money, small amounts. The Vaughan Williams Trust gave us £1,000 early on. Now, I mean, that is nothing in a way, you could say, in compared to a whole budget for film, but it's actually very significant because they've never backed a film before in their 60-year history. And they understood that Vaughan Williams was actually entrusted with the legacy of Butterworth in a way, because Butterworth left his folk song manuscripts to Vaughan Williams in the event of his death. They then passed into the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library, so named, at Cecil Sharp House in London. So the Vaughan Williams Trust knew that it was a very much a project in the spirit of what they should be doing. And we were delighted to get that backing from them, which they'd say they'd never given before. Other than that, we survived on favours, on goodwill and ingenuity, really, using our imagination. And we went to, and kindness. All the archives we went to, the Bodleian Library, the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library, Eton College Library, the Durham County Record Office, they threw open their doors for us and they allowed us to obtain images of the materials, or even in most cases to go in and physically film it. I mean, Martin Holmes at the Bodleian gave us an afternoon where he led us through their collection of manuscripts and scrapbooks and things that only exist there. And, that was incredibly generous of them to do. But I think it's because they understood what the project was aiming for, and they wanted, archivists and librarians actually want their materials to see the light of day and to be up on screen or wherever. They don't want them to be locked away behind closed doors or only to special visitors. So, there's that as well. But we were subject to so many instances and examples of goodwill along the way. It's unbelievable. And it really felt like a team effort, even though I've done the principal roles, of director, editor, photographer, producer or co-producer. It wasn't just me at all. It was a lot of people who made the film possible, and it really, the whole thing rests on their contributions, really.
So the film itself is kind of touring the country, as it were, playing in different cinemas and different arts centre venues across the country. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, is it on near me? You can find it online. There's quite a lot of sort of online archive and link, isn't there? So where should folks go to find that?
Yes, James. The film is screening in independent cinemas and arts centres around the country. The film has a website, georgebutterworth.co.uk. So it's all one word, georgebutterworth.co.uk. And within that website is a screenings page, which is updated on a rolling basis as we confirm new bookings. And we've got a good list of bookings through the summer. We're screening about 12 times between now and the end of July, in fact. And so, yeah, anyone who's interested can go onto the site and see if there's a screening coming up near them. And if there isn't, they're very welcome to drop me a line and suggest any local cinema where they might like to see the film. And I'll happily approach that cinema with an offer of the film for a screening.
Excellent. So what next for you and what next for the film?
Well, I'm now fully occupied in promoting and booking, distributing the film. And I also still have a part-time job back in London where I'm based. And I'm travelling out with each screening of the film to attend and participate in audience discussions afterwards, which we find to be quite a worthwhile part of each screening, and I think audiences have appreciated that part of it too. So that will continue for as long as the film cinema run goes on, and we really want to show the film to people in cinemas as far as we can, because we do believe in the experience of visiting a cinema, which, you know, there's lots of ways nowadays of consuming films, but we do believe that the best way is in a cinema, you know, in a theatrical setting with a large screen, with really good quality sound, and with a darkened room, and also a communal atmosphere. We're not just watching one by one at home in our bedrooms. We're actually coming together with other people, and even if you're not directly, you know, talking to those other people around you, you're in the atmosphere of a communal space. And your behaviour and your receptors and your experience of what you see and hear is all coloured by that. And we really value that experience. So it's actually, for us, an honour to be able to show the film in such rarefied, you know, circumstances as a cinema. And we're going to continue to try and pursue that and get as many screenings for the film as we can.
Well, Stuart, congratulations on the film. And it's been great to talk to you. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me, James. I'm grateful to you. Thank you.
For more information on the man and the film, go to www.georgebutterworth.co.uk. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Emily, Helena and the players at Birmingham Folk Ensemble, Jez Collins and the Birmingham Musical Archive, Stuart Morgan Hadukievich, Mac Birmingham, 448 Creative and M7PR. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.